So we're very fortunate in this life to have met the Dharma teachings, and especially to have met His Holiness the Dalai Lama and had the opportunity to listen to teachings from him. So this is not a common occurrence in samsara. It's a very rare occurrence. So to try and appreciate that and make good use of our opportunity, especially to cultivate the bodhicitta. Because with the bodhicitta, then everything we do, motivated by that intention, becomes virtuous, and it just creates a huge amount of merit, because our motivation is for the welfare of all sentient beings. So let's have that motivation, and let's respect the people who have that motivation and learn from them and take their Dharma instructions to heart so that we can become like them. So whatever environment we live in, we take what we have there for granted. We really solidify it. And so, you know, encountering His Holiness Dalai Lama, listening to teachings, we do it every day. You know, we have teachings. We can go online and listen to His Holiness's videos whenever we want. So it just seems, everything seems very plentiful, and we tend to take it for granted. But when we really have a big picture and think of the experience of other sentient beings in the samsara, and the big picture of what samsara is and what other living beings are going through now, and how they really can't meet the Dharma or hear teachings from somebody the quality of saliness, then we begin to see that what we take for granted is actually extremely rare, and that we're very privileged. So I think it's important for us to have that awareness, because then it really makes our life so much more vivid, and it increases our intention to practice. Whereas if we don't have that awareness, then it's like, it's Friday night. Teachings. You know? So, yeah, we don't really want to go through our lives like that, do we? No. We want to go through our lives really, with vibrancy and appreciation. Okay, so here we are in Approaching the Buddhist Path, and we are on page 22, okay? The section about mind, body, rebirth, and self. So here it is, you know, right at the beginning. People are brand new. And what does His Holiness do? He socks it to them, you know. He gives the first couple of chapters about compassion and easing things in. And then, you know, he really respects the audience, you know, because he knows people, especially in the West, have had an education. And so he tells them the philosophy, because he wants them to know what it is and to think about it. Yeah. So here we go. And it's, it's talking about mind-body rebirth right at the beginning. And it's such a new concept for most of the people. So you could say that he's really, what would you say, being daring. Yeah. But from his viewpoint, no, this is something that people need to know and think about. Okay. So our body and mind influence each other while we're alive, although they have different natures and different continua. or continuums, both are okay in English. The body is material and depends on physical causes, such as the sperm and egg of our parents, to come into existence. The food we eat, also material in nature, is the condition that allows our body to survive and grow. The mind, however, is not matter and cannot be known or measured by scientific instruments designed to measure matter. Okay, so matter is atomic in nature. Scientific instruments are designed to measure it. Yeah, but the mind is that which is clear and cognizant, and scientific instruments don't have the tools to measure it because it's personal experience. How do you know the mind exists? You know, it's because you experience it yourself. Yeah. But it's interesting, you know, how some people aren't even sure what the mind is. They're not sure if the mind exists. But if you really think about it, yeah, what is it that makes the difference between a corpse and a living being? And you've got to be able to posit something. According to those who advocate scientific reductionism, the mind is nothing more than the brain. I think I told you the stories of one of the Mind and Life conferences. It was back in 1989, the year His Holiness won the Nobel Peace Prize. And, there was a Mind and Life conference, and there were a couple of scientific reductionists there. And really for them, you know, the mind was the brain. And it was amazing for me, you know, that they had no introspective awareness to look at their own experience and to say, what is it that's thinking and feeling and cognizing? Yeah, that just wasn't in their view of life. And yet if you think that there's only matter and there's no consciousness, then it's all very strange, because then matter would have to think and feel and experience, which matter doesn't, you know. I mean, the table doesn't, and the cells in the Petri dish don't. Other scientists, however, assert that the mind is a function of brain processes, and that mental processes and emotional experiences either correlate with or are due to biochemical processes in the brain. So these people are kind of a step beyond, you know, closer, beyond, you know, than the people that are just, you know, everything is material. Because they say, okay, there's some experience, mental processes, but it is the chemical, electrical processes in the brain. And, you know, everything's still quite affiliated with material things. However, many aspects of our mind cannot be accounted for by this neuroscientific view. Yeah, by saying, you know, that the mind is these biochemical things, or the biochemical things are what allow the person to experience something. There's some holes in that theory. So as Holiness says, by simply looking at chemical processes in the brain, we cannot determine if a thought is valid, if it is an instance of knowledge or affliction. By examining brain processes, we cannot discern whether a mental event is a direct perceiver of a sense object or a conception, such as a memory or a thought about something. Yeah. So he's talked with enough scientists, you know, and learned enough about the brain to know that, okay, you know, you can measure these kinds of chemical and electrical things, but you can't always predict, according to what they are, what the person's experience is. Okay? So you might be able to tell the person's thinking about something, but you can't tell whether the thought is a reasonable thought or one that's completely off the wall. the scientific data doesn't give you that information. You can maybe able to tell something's going on in the brain, but you can't tell if it's a direct perceiver from the senses or a conceptual thought. Yeah. And then he goes on here, at the experiential level, there's a great difference between the pain we experience due to our own situation and the pain that comes from compassion for others' suffering. The experience of our own pain arises involuntarily and forcefully, and we usually respond to it with fear and anger. The pain that is attendant upon compassion for another's suffering has an element of deliberate sharing and embracing of that pain, and we react to it with courage. However, in terms of the biochemical processes in the brain, these two types of pain are indistinguishable. Isn't that interesting? Yeah, that what's going on in the brain, if you look at somebody, if you are being, let's say, hit yourself or insulted yourself, are the same biochemical things that are going on if you look at somebody else being hit or insulted and have compassion for them. So it's two very different situations, that yet the same thing is going on in the brain, the same physical thing. Yeah? So they can tell, you know, okay, so this is kind of is going on, pain's being experienced. But beyond that, you know, the brain can't tell you really even whose pain, you know, if it's an, or if it's an involuntary pain or a pain that with compassion we are willing to experience. Yeah, the brain can't tell us that. Tears can well up in our eyes when we are very joyful or very sad. On the physical level, our eyes do not distinguish the two. But on the mental level, there is a big difference in the cause of the tears and how we experience them. So again, you know, here's a physical event that could come from two very, very different reasons. And yet the physical event is exactly the same thing. Okay. For all these reasons, it is difficult to claim that all aspects of our experiential consciousness can be explained simply through the biological processes of the brain. All functioning things that produce effects, come about due to causes and conditions. To trace back the causes and conditions of our present body, we follow a sequence of material causes and effects that go to our parents and generations of previous ancestors. Scientists posit the theory of evolution when tracing back the origin of the human body. Before life existed on Earth, the continua of the physical elements that later became our bodies were present, and their continua are traced back to the Big Bang. Okay, so our bodies, you want to trace back the substantial cause? It's all material things, and you can go back to the Big Bang, and there's got to be something before the Big Bang. I mean, we know there is because there was such dense areas of matter before the Big Bang that, you know, something's going on there. Since matter, be it gross or subtle, was present at the time of the Big Bang and even before it, its causes must also have been matter or energy that can transform into matter. Although our body wasn't present when this universe began to form, its present continuity in the form of material causes and physical elements was. Its previous continuity, its present continuity. Anyway, both make sense, kind of. Okay, so that's the scientific presentation. Then, according to the Kala Chakra Tantra, the ultimate source of the body is space particles that exist between the disappearance of the previous universe and the production of the subsequent one. They provide the continuum of potential for material during that time. containing a trace of each of the gross or elemental particles. They are the basic stuff from which all other forms arise when a new universe develops. So science may have the theory of, the Big Bang, and then the universe expanding, and then contracting, and then another universe coming into existence. And so there's some continuity of matter from the scientific viewpoint. And also from the Buddhist viewpoint, they say that all matter can, we have the earth, water, fire, and wind particles that during the eon, they call it the empty eon, when there isn't a universe there, then there's space particles that contain the potentials or the traces of these other material particles. Okay, so both ways, there's some kind of substantial continuity there. It's difficult to identify the essential characteristics of the mind. On a daily level, we experience sensory perceptions and the thoughts that chase after objects of the senses. Sense perceivers are visual, auditory, olfactory, gustatory, and tactile consciousnesses, focus on the external world and assume the aspect of the objects they perceive. The conceptual mind that thinks about these objects also assumes the aspect of these external objects. And even when our mind is directed inwards to our own feelings, it assumes the aspect of the feelings. So it's difficult for us to separate out the clarity and cognizance of the mind and be aware of the mind alone without also being aware of its objects. However, with meditation, it is possible to experience the nature of the mind, here meaning the conventional mind. So you can see, just in our own experience, our mind is so involved with sense objects, either with the senses functioning outside, color, shape, sound, smell, taste, touch, everything outside, experiencing that, or thinking about it. So even, we may say, well, what about attachment to my reputation or attachment to praise? That isn't material. But reputation, praise, all those things are all based on the external world and external sense objects. What is praise? It's sound. What is reputation? It's objects of sight or objects of sound. Yeah. So even these emotional needs or mental things are all linked to external objects. Yeah. I mean, if you think about it, if you weren't involved with the external world, would you even care what your reputation was? If you weren't involved, if you didn't know anything about an external world, would you care about being praised? No, all that comes about because we're so directed outwards towards the sense object. Yeah. And so it's interesting there to notice not only the attachment for the sense objects, my thermos or my clock, but attachment to the sense objects that create the emotional things that we need: recognition, praise, reputation, companionship. All of that is dependent on external things as well. Yeah, it's really rather shocking when you think of it. Yeah, and so we're so involved with all that stuff that it's hard for us to even think about what's going on in our mind, let alone identify just the clarity and cognizance that is the nature of the conventional mind. Yeah, because the mind's always involved with one object or another. Or we're asleep, in deep sleep, and you know, we're not aware of anything going on. So, you know, when we're trying with meditation to identify the conventional mind, it's not going to be so easy. Because, you know, we've never looked at it before. Results are produced from concordant causes. Concordant causes are causes that have the ability to produce those specific results. They cannot arise from discordant causes. So what would be a discordant cause for an apple tree? A peach seed, okay? What would be the concordant cause for an apple tree? Apple seed, okay? So this kind of thing, that, you know, it sounds mundane, but we've got to be able to really understand what it means. Since the mind is immaterial, its substantial cause, the principal thing that transforms into a particular moment of mind, must also be immaterial. This is the preceding moment of mind. One moment of mind arises due to the previous moment of mind, which arose due to the moment of mind that preceded it. This can be traced back to the time of conception. The moment of mind at the time of conception arose due to a cause, a previous moment of mind. And in this way, the continuum of mind prior to this life is established. Yeah. So if you just sit and think about it, this is one of the first meditations I did when I first met the Dharma that Rinpoche had us do, is start with the present moment, then, you know, get a feel for your mind, and then think, you know, this moment of mind came from the mind when I, you know, it's a result of the mind when I came in and sat down here. And then that mind is a result from this morning's mind, which is a result of yesterday's mind. And then you keep thinking about how each moment of mind depends on the preceding moment of mind. And you go back and you realize, you know, how little actually we remember of our lives. You know, could you sit down? I mean, even today, you know, it just happened. Could you go back and remember every single moment of everything you did today? No. Yeah? Isn't that amazing? It just happened. But there's no way we could remember it every single moment. Yeah, we think we're really smart. But if you think about it, we know that each moment of mind depended on the previous moment, and that today's mind depended on yesterday's mind, and, you know, that there's a continuity from when we were 15 years old and when we were 10 and when we were 5, and, you know, and then you go back to your first memory when you were a kid, whatever it was that you remember. And then, you know, well, what happened the day before that or the year before that? Oh, we can't remember. But that doesn't mean that we didn't have a mind. Yeah, because we can look at babies and toddlers now and we can see, yeah, they all have minds. Yeah, they experience pain and pleasure. They want happiness, not suffering. And you trace that back to the moment of birth. And then similarly into the womb, you know. Now, certainly our experience in the womb was very different than our experience now. One of the main differences is we have much more knowledge now and our conceptual faculty is really developed. When we were in the womb, we didn't have much conceptual ability and we didn't know enough to even think about anything. We were just experiencing stuff. You know, our mother walked and we're going, and we have no idea, oh, my mother is walking. All we knew is, you know, and they say our mother eats chili. And we don't know, oh, my mother ate chili and, you know, it'll go away after a while and that's it. All we know is, you know, the experience of, what happens after our mother eats chili peppers, yeah, or whatever is going on. You know, we have no ability to understand what is happening to us. And so you can imagine the kind of fear and turmoil that happens because there's no ability to place experience within an understanding of the world. Yeah. And I see that like with the kiddies, you know, yeah, one moment of mine came from the next moment of mine. But, you know, they hear a loud sound and instantly they react with fright. There's no ability to think, oh, there's a loud sound, but it's probably nothing. Yeah. Of course, many people react the same way as the kiddies. Okay. Or, you know, we have to take them to the vet. And, you know, and they're like petrified being put in the kitty cage and in the car and going to the vet and all these sounds and everything going on. Whereas when we go to the doctor, you know, we know, okay, I'm going to the doctor and I'm going to see this and I'm going to hear that. And we may or may not like it, but we have an idea of what these sense experiences are. So, you know, when we're very young or even in the womb, there's none of this kind of awareness. Yeah, there's just the sense experience and our reaction to it. But then you keep tracing each moment of mind back to the moment of conception. And conception is, from a Buddhist viewpoint, defined as when the sperm and egg and consciousness are all coming together. So it could be that the sperm and egg meet and then the consciousness, or that the consciousness is in the sperm and then the sperm and egg meet, so the three of them are together. But, you know, it has to be the three coming together. That's the moment of conception. And then, of course, from before that, the moment of consciousness before that would be in the bardo. And then again, bardo is the intermediate stage between one life and the next. And then again, that moment of mind depends on the previous moment and the previous moment and so on into the previous life.
Someone asked, would the mother's mind affect the child in the womb?
I think if the mother had different sorts of emotions, the mother's emotions affects the mother's body. And, you know, the feeling of, you know, whatever hormonal changes or whatever happened in the mother would affect the child. And probably just the energy of one emotion or another would affect the child. I mean, because we know you just sit next to somebody who's experiencing a certain emotion and that can affect you. Conception is the coming together of the sperm, egg, and subtle mind. This creates a new life. The material aspect of this life, the sperm and egg, come from the parents. The immaterial conscious aspect, the mind, does not come from the parents. If it did, if you got half your mind from your mother and half your mind from your father, you know, then we would have to say that our parents really lost their mind when they had us. Yeah? So the mind does not come from the parents. So the mind must come from a previous moment of mind, which at the moment of conception is the mind of a being in the previous life. Actually, the bardo is considered the present life, but for the sake of this argument, we call it the previous life. At the time of death, the bardo and the body and mind separate. Here, too, they have different continua. The body becomes a corpse and is recycled in nature. The mind continues on, one moment of mind producing the next. In the case of ordinary beings, the mind usually takes a new body and another life begins. And what is it that makes the consciousness of an ordinary being take a new body and begin a new life? Karma. Okay. Well, yeah, the karma is the primary thing. the karma is ripened by the clinging and craving, by the craving and clinging, because in that order. Buddhist scriptures describe different levels and types of mind. In terms of levels of mind, there are coarse consciousnesses, such as our five sense consciousnesses, subtler consciousness, such as our mental consciousness that thinks and dreams, and the subtlest mind that becomes manifest in ordinary beings at the time of death. This subtlest mind, which goes from one life to the next, can persist without depending on the coarse physical body, including the brain and the nervous system. The subtlest mind is a continuity of ever-changing moments of mind. It is not a permanent self or soul. The terms subtlest mind and fundamental innate mind of clear light are merely designated in dependence on a continuum of extremely subtle transitory moments of clarity and cognizance. Okay, so while the gross level of consciousness is very related to the body and what's going on with the body, the extremely subtle level of consciousness can be present and can act independent of the body. Okay? So, at the time of death, the very highly realized practitioners, it's called the practice of Tokdam, where they meditate in the fundamental innate mind of clear light. They meditate on emptiness. And the breath has stopped. The heart has stopped. The brain waves have stopped. But the consciousness, the extremely subtle consciousness, is still in the body. So those meditators, Kyabche Ling Rinpoche, who was just here, okay, when his previous life died in 1983, I think it was, then, you know, the breath, brain, heart, everything stopped. He was sitting in meditation position. Everything, although the subtle winds and everything had dissolved into the heart chakra, and the subtle mind, extremely subtle mind, was active and manifest at that time. So when he was sitting up, the body was sitting up, and it wasn't like this, it was sitting up. But there were no vital signs going on. The body itself was not warm, but there was a little bit of heat right here. And he meditated for 13 days in that state. And then when his meditation was finished and the extremely subtle mind left the body, at that time, then the went like this, okay? Another lama that I met, Dorsang Rinpoche, he's from the Kagyu tradition. He was at Beer, or I forget where he lived, somewhere in Himachal Pradesh. Very, very nice lama. And he passed away this last year. And Yessi, of Peter and Yessi, sent me the link to of a short video where I think it was his attendant, you know, Rinpoche's body was sitting up and it was all covered the way they you know, put the hat on it and the robes and everything the way they do with a body. And the attendant showed that he reached in, he took out Rinpoche's arm, and there was no rigor mortis. He took out the arm and he went like this, you know, because Rinpoche was, you know, still meditating in there. The body, there was no rigor mortis. Yeah. Even when our kitties, Achala and Manjushri, died, this was really amazing. It makes you wonder who these cats were. Yeah. But their bodies, both of them, their bodies did not start to smell immediately. And their body was also flexible. There was no rigor mortis. Yeah. So I think it took Achi several days. Actually, we took him to be buried, and his body, we didn't figure out until we had put him in there, that the body was still flexible. And Manji, I think it was about a week, something like that, yeah, before there was any smell from the body. I don't know who those cats were, but something was going on.
Just when I started to go to the Buddhist Center in Dunedin, one of the lamas died there, and he was in Tukdam for 18 days, and health department were getting quite worried, and there was people coming in like, what's going on? And
yeah.
One of them just felt the energy within the room, and he said, I can't go in. But for 18 days, I didn't see her go in because I was in your mind. I had no idea what was going on, but quite something.
Yeah. Do you remember the name of the lama?
Thupten Rinpoche. He was one of the two students that Geshe Noah Dagi escaped with from Tibet. Laga Rinpoche, who's still alive, who's in the he's in Dunedin at the moment, and then Thupten Rinpoche.
Okay. And Geshe Zopa also, after he passed away, stayed at Thupten for a while. So there's ways, you know, that's why we kind of have to make contact with the health department beforehand and let them know that, you know, because even ordinary beings that aren't doing Thupten may stay for like up to 3 days in the body. So it's good to, we should do that now. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And get it in writing so that the health department knows what's going on. Okay. The Buddha explained the continuity of life and rebirth principally on the basis of the continuity of mind. The continuity of mind across lifetimes is not the gross level of mind that is dependent on the physical body. It is the subtlest mind, the fundamental innate mind of clear light, that is the final designation of the person that connects one life with the next. The detailed explanation of this mind is found only in texts from the highest yoga class of Buddhist Tantra. Okay, so the fundamental innate mind of clear light is extremely subtle. You know, it's only really described in highest yoga Tantra, where there are then procedures for making it manifest and using it to realize emptiness. And that's one of the things that makes Tantra very quick and very effective, is because if you can get the most subtle level of mind realizing emptiness, then it purifies that very subtle mind, which is important. So our gross personality does not go from one life to the next. Yeah. So it's not like, I saw some movie many years ago about, I don't know what it was even called, but, you know, a family and the husband, I don't know, he got in an accident or something. And then it was like his soul or something came out of the body. There was some, you know, foggy shaped thing, and then went over into a dog. Okay, who then was, you know, went to the family and was protecting the family, and the dog seemed to know all these things that the rest of the family couldn't figure out how the dog knew it. So, but it's not like that. Okay, it's not like your personality goes from one life to the next. And it's pretty, you know, I don't know, traumatic. Even, you know, I mean, it's a big change leaving one body going into the next. And so it's not like you're consciously going to remember everything. You know, it depends on what level of practice somebody's at. But it's not that everybody who's called a Rinpoche, you know, is a bodhisattva or even consciously directed their mind. Sometimes it just, they just have the karma to be called Rinpoche. But yeah, it's not like the whole personality picks up and moves over. You know, when you hear descriptions of the 13th Dalai Lama, a very different personality than the 14th Dalai Lama. Yeah. But it's so interesting that as much as we hear about, you know, it's one moment of mind, there's no soul, there's no permanent personality, everything's arising and ceasing in every moment, it's just amazing when people meet the incarnation of their previous teacher, they're all sitting there waiting for their teacher to recognize them. And then after they meet the teacher, everybody's talking, did he recognize you? Did he recognize you? And it's like, huh? You know, we just got done studying about the mind and the continuity of mind, and there's no soul and there's no personality. And, you know, why are you thinking like this? Okay. But it's really funny. People do. Yeah. And then they get, oh, my goodness. They put the little tulkus are the subject of so many people's namtok. Namtok means preconceptions, superstitions, you know, because everybody, oh, there's a tulku, and they project everything, you know, on this poor little kid. It's not enviable, yeah, when you really think about it. So many expectations on your head. Everybody trying to control you and wanting you to be this and wanting you to be that. And then all the etiquette and, you know, the Tibetan, you know, who can visit who and how you have to act towards everybody else. And, yeah, you're really, you know. So, yeah, so you really see often that people who aren't recognized have much more freedom and can relax. Yeah. Because even you look at, you know, Ling Rinpoche. I mean, since they found him when he was 18 months old. Yeah. He could never go outside and just play. Yeah. Because if he went outside alone, he would be swamped by everybody coming and wanting him to give them a blessing. Yeah. He couldn't just go outside and walk down the street. Yeah. Or go outside and play with his friends. Because he only could be with certain people. And he's a high lama. And he couldn't go visit those other lamas. Because he was higher. They had to come and visit him. And all this stuff going on. It's, yeah. When you think about it, I think you have to have a great degree of patience. You know, what Westerners are all excited, oh, maybe I'm a Rinpoche. Yeah. You know, everybody kind of goes through this, you know. Oh, I really clicked with the Dharma. The Dharma really hit me and has meant so much to me, and it really feels like home. And, you know, maybe I'm a Rinpoche and I just haven't been recognized. And wouldn't it be cool if I were a Rinpoche? You know, and then you have people coming in and, you know, asking one lama or another to identify them. Yeah. And it's like, I've seen the lives of these Rinpoches. It's not fun. It's not fun having everybody just flittering around you all the time like that. Or at least it wouldn't be fun for me. Because my permanent personality would not like it. Yeah. So it's an interesting system that they have, the tulku system. But anyway, we won't go into that right now. Rebirth can also be validated by personal experience. I heard about a Tibetan boy who could read without being taught. Some people may say this is due to his genetic makeup, but to me it makes more sense to say it is due to the continuity of his consciousness from a previous life. I also heard about an Indian girl who had many memories of her previous life. Her parents from her previous life and the parents from this life met and confirmed the details. Both now accept her as their daughter, so she has four parents. Yeah, His Holiness often tells that story. Yangtze Rinpoche, when he was very little, I heard that in his sleep he could just recite texts that he hadn't memorized in this life, but had memorized in a previous life. And then also Bhikkhu Anālayo, a German monk, yeah, you know him? So I know him from several years. And he just wrote a book, and he had an interview on the Wisdom podcast. I think it'd be nice if we got the book, but he was telling the story because he lived some time in Sri Lanka, and he had a friend who was an adult, but when his friend was a child, he would recite he could chant Pali without ever being taught, and he knew all these Pali chants, but the chants were a little bit different than the present versions of the chants. And Anālayo, being a scholar, you know, said, well, of course, because something that's very ancient, you know, that's passed down in an oral tradition, is going to change over time, and a little bit may be added, a little bit may be taken back. And he said also that because people had taped the child chanting the Pali, that there was a difference in the accent or the way of pronunciation and everything. So for Anālayo, that kind of indicated that, you know, it was something happening due to previous life. And Anālayo said that he had never thought much about previous lives, you know. He said it's very clear that the Buddha taught them in the early scriptures, but he never thought much about it. And then, you know, he had this friend. And then, so that made him really think about, you know, previous lives and remembering these kinds of things. And then his friend told him that he remembered being with Buddhaghosa. Yeah. So Buddhaghosa lived in the 5th century, and that would make perfect sense for why his way of pronouncing Pali was different, why the versions of the chant, there was some difference. And, you know, there were certain Banakas who were monks at that time who had the job to memorize different sets of sutras. And so it sounded like his friend in a previous life was one of those Banakas who had memorized it. He thought it was maybe the Digha Nikaya, the long discourses. Yeah. So kind of amazing. Yeah.
I saw some years back a video on and I think it's YouTube, about this Colombian boy. Probably not more than 6 or 7, I say, when this was taped. But basically, he was conducting mass in his home, and his parent and older brother were the audience. And this child had basically memorized the entire mass, but he was repeating everything from memory. I mean, it was astounding. But what impressed me the most was not just that he was saying the mass like a priest would say it, mm-hmm. but that he, in doing so, he acquired the affect, yes, of a priest saying mass. I mean, looking at this child, you would have no doubt that this is a priest basically saying mass. It was just like mind-boggling, and the kid, probably not older than 6 or 7. So, yeah. Quite amazing.
You see those kinds of things. When Tsurkhan Rinpoche and Ling Rinpoche were very, very little, a couple of times we took Tsurkhan Rinpoche up to the Ling Laprang up the hill, and there was a meadow behind, and the two of them could run around and play there. And it was very interesting to watch them play because they would play initiation. And Ling Rinpoche would sit on top of this rock and Tsurkhan Rinpoche sit at the bottom of the rock. And Ling Rinpoche would kind of teach him, and then they'd take a bottle of water and, you know, give it to them and then come around to all the rest of us, and give us a little bit of the water from the bottle of water. I mean, that's what these kids played. Yeah. interesting.
I find it curious that Bhikkhu and Alu hadn't thought much about previous lives. Is that not emphasized in the Theravada presentation?
Or? No, but he just kind of accepted it. They don't have, it seems like, how His Holiness is explaining it, previous lives in terms of the substantial cause of the body and the substantial cause of the mind and every impermanent phenomena arising from a previous mind. You know, all that logic that actually comes from Pramnavartika. We started to get into it with Geshe Thupke this year. They don't have that in their system. Yeah. So you mention rebirth, but there's no, and people accept it, but there's no proof, logical proof that's, you know, being taught. They don't have this thing of identifying previous great masters. So, you know, it was just something that was there that he didn't, you know, do a big thing for him. But what was very interesting in the podcast is, you know, because there's some people now who want to, quote, modernize Buddhism and free it up from superstition and myth. And they're going around saying that the Buddha didn't teach rebirth. And so Analia, who's a scholar of the early Buddhist suttas, said very clearly, the Buddha taught rebirth, you know. And if you read those scriptures, it's very clear the Buddha did that. So it was nice that he said that. Yeah. Whether other people believe him or not is another issue. But generally speaking, once a mind conjoins with a fertilized egg, a new life has begun. In dependence on that body and mind, we designate person, living being, I or self. Our outlook on life, perceptions, feelings, and emotions are all based on the notion of a self. Isn't that interesting? Yeah. Everything that goes on in our mind is based on the notion of a self. Yeah. We say, I did this, I think that, I feel sad or happy. Although this is our experience, seldom have we stopped to ask ourselves, who is this I upon which everything is predicated? The question regarding the identity of the self is important because it is the self, the I, that wants to be happy and to avoid suffering. If the self existed independently from other phenomena, we should be able to isolate and identify it. The Buddha taught that a person is composed of five psychophysical aggregates: form, feeling, discrimination, miscellaneous factors, and consciousness. The form aggregate is our body, and the other four aggregates constitute our mind. If we search among these five aggregates, we cannot pinpoint a person who is totally separate from them. Nor can we identify a person who is identical to his or her body or mind or the collection. The collection of the two also is not a person. A person exists independent on his mind and body, but is neither totally one with them nor completely separate from them. If we were totally one with one of the aggregates, then it would have to be one aggregate, and we would be that aggregate. So the I, the person, would be the body, or be the feelings, or be the consciousness. Yeah, but that's not how we feel, is it? You know, sometimes we may feel I am my body. But then we turn around and say, well, I thought about this. And if we were our body, then the self and the body would be synonyms. Yeah. So then if you said, I was thinking about this, you would have to say, the body was thinking about this. Or if we thought we were the mind, and were identical with the mind, then when we said, I was walking down the street, we would have to say, the mind was walking down the street. Okay? So we're not totally identical with either the body or the mind, and yet we're not something completely separate from them either. Because if we were, then we wouldn't say, I'm thinking, you know, because thinking depends on the body, on the mind. And we couldn't say, I'm walking, because walking depends on the body. So everything we say that the self does is actually in relationship to either the body or the mind, because the body or mind does it. Yeah, so we aren't identical, we aren't totally separate. The self depends on the body. When our body is ill, we say, I'm sick. If the self were a separate entity from the body, we could not say this. The self also depends on the mind. When the mind is happy, we say, I'm happy. If the self were separate from the mind, we couldn't say this. On the basis of the mind seeing a flower, we say that the person possessing that mind sees the flower. Other than this, we cannot find a person who sees something. So think about that. Other than the fact that the mind is seeing the flower, there is no separate person who is seeing the flower. But when you see a flower, how do you look at it? Yeah, I'm seeing the flower. We don't think my mind is seeing the flower. I'm seeing the flower. The mind is what's doing the work for me so that I can perceive the flower. But I'm the one perceiving it. So it's interesting because, you know, everything we say about ourselves is in one way or another related to the body or mind. And yet we feel like we're separate from the body and mind, but we clearly can't be totally separate. In short, I is designated independence on our body and mind. Yet when we search for a findable thing that is me, we cannot find it within the body, the mind, the collection of the two, or separate from them. This indicates that the person exists dependently. We lack an inherent, findable, unchanging essence. Since we lack an independent self, we can change, grow, and progress from confusion to awakening. So there's no soul. Yeah. Now, how many of you grew up learning that there was a soul? Yeah. It's amazing. And yet here it is, you know, there's no soul. But when you learn that kind of stuff when you're little, do you really believe there's no soul? Do you really believe there's no soul? If you grew up hearing that there was a soul and you've heard that since you were little, when you come to Buddhism and you hear there's no soul, and you hear this kind of description about how the I is dependent on the body and mind, but not separate from them, not one with them. Yeah. How do you feel? Yeah. Do you kind of say, yeah, Buddhism makes sense, but underneath, there's still something that's really me that God created. Yeah. That God's going to protect. It's very interesting, you know, to really look deeply inside and, you know, how do we feel about things? What is lurking in there as an unexamined belief that it would be good to examine using some reasoning to see if it's possible for a soul to exist. Because if there were a permanent soul, that soul was the essence of who we were, then there's no way we could change. We would be permanent. Yeah? Some permanent soul that is the essence of me that doesn't change would mean that I can't change. But what's our experience? We change. So our concept and our experience are not matching. There's discordance here. Okay. Quite interesting.
I think one of the hard parts for me, and this is a hard part for me, the whole soul thing, and I think that I always had a belief, not only did I have a soul, but that to work on myself mm-hmm. was to change my soul and make it better or work on it. And so I didn't ever really see it as unchangeable. In fact, I saw it as changeable, and that was what I was working on to try to become better.
Mm.
That makes sense.
Okay. But I'm not expert in how Christians are brought up, because I wasn't brought up Christian. But are you brought up that, yeah, your job is to work and change yourself and change your soul, but there's still a soul that's the essence of you? So what you're taught is something that's actually contradictory. There's a soul that's the essence of you that never changes, and it's always the essence of you. And yet, you're supposed to change it.
And I guess as we talk about it, one of the things I'll have to think about is what I was really being taught, that I needed to be more in line with the soul that my Christian values were telling me I should have. Is that really what I was trying to change myself to fit into? Because mm-hmm. it was already there and I needed to get there to it. So
yeah.
That'll be interesting to think about.
Yeah, to really check up. And sometimes what this leads to, you know, because there's some discordance here, is we try and form a compromise. The soul is really permanent, but certain aspects of it change.
Yes.
Okay? And we see when Aryadeva starts refuting the non-Buddhists in the 400, this is one of the theories that he refutes. And we can understand why people came up with it. It's a good compromise, isn't it? You know, there's something really that's me that's unchanging, so I don't need to ever be afraid, because this thing is never going to go out of existence. It's permanent, and it's me. But it can change too. And if you think about it, one thing can't be both permanent and impermanent. It's totally impossible. But our mind, when there's discordance, then we develop theories to kind of mute the discordance. But we don't really want to examine those theories, because the moment we start examining them with reasoning, they can't hold up. Yeah, and when you've believed in a soul your entire life, and that's been your security, my soul, I'm never going to go out of existence, and then you start to think maybe that doesn't exist, it makes you really skittish. Yeah, and all this grasping comes up. Yeah, whereas if you've studied Buddha Dharma for a while, and you've come to see that a permanent soul is impossible to exist, and that if you were a permanent soul, then you would be forever confined to samsara, and you could never purify your mind to become a Buddha, then if you had that and you had a lot of merit, then when you started to think about there's no soul, you feel an incredible sense of relief. Like, oh, thank goodness. Yeah, because if this thing were so, then I would be had. Yeah, so it's actually good. And then meditating on emptiness becomes easier because you see it as something that will bring you happiness and liberation instead of something that's going to destroy what you've been holding on to for a really long time. But this is where accumulating merit comes in. Yeah, so we have to accumulate merit to be able to sustain that kind of thing. The person or self creates the causes for happiness and suffering. The person also experiences the pleasurable and painful results of these actions. Although we cannot pinpoint anything that is the self, the existence of a person who creates causes and experiences effects is undeniable. So we can't pinpoint a self, but there's a person that functions and experiences things. And then you begin to see if that person were permanent, it couldn't function and experience things. Countless sentient beings have this feeling of self, although it is difficult to identify what that self is. His Holiness presents this so skillfully, you know? However, the fact that each and every sentient being wants happiness and not suffering is indisputable. No reason is needed to prove this. Being born, enjoying life, enduring suffering, and dying are conditioned phenomena that are products of previous causes. If there were no person who experiences them, none of these would be tenable. Yeah, there would be no birth if there were no person who were born. Okay. Similarly, we distinguish afflictive samsaric existence from the awakened state of nirvana based on whether the person has gained realizations. This distinction between samsara and nirvana would be irrelevant if no person existed. There was no person, nobody's in samsara, nobody wants to attain nirvana. The self exists, but from the perspective of the deeper nature of reality, our view of it is mistaken. This incongruity between how the self actually exists and how we apprehend it is the source of all our confusion and suffering. It sounds so simple, doesn't it? The incongruity between how the self actually exists and how we apprehend it. You know, that's all it is. You know? Yeah, we just misapprehend things like, you know, like seeing the snow on a mountain is blue instead of white, or thinking a scarecrow is a human being, or thinking that there are people inside a TV screen. Yeah, it's just a misapprehension like that. And that's the source of all our confusion and suffering. It's mind-boggling when you think about it, isn't it? You know, it's not like there's, you know, some monster persecuting us, keeping us in suffering, or some, you know, horrible something that we can never change. It's just a misapprehension. Yeah. As we cultivate correct views, our mental strength increases. This leads to mental peace, which in turn brings joy and a sense of fulfillment. A mental state that sees the world as it is free from fear and anxiety. lot to think about in here, isn't there? Yeah. My goodness. Okay, so then there's 3 points for the reflection to do between now and next week. So one, the body is material in nature, the mind is immaterial. While the brain and the mind influence each other, they are not the same. So think about that. How are they different? How do they influence each other? Our body and its substantial cause, the sperm and egg of our parents, are both material. Our mind and its substantial cause, the previous moment of mind, are immaterial. They are mere clarity and cognizance. At the time of conception, they meet, forming a new life. That's it. At the time of death, the continuity of the body is a corpse that decomposes to become material elements. The continuity of mind in the form of the very subtle mind continues to the next life, if you're an ordinary being. Okay? So, lots to contemplate here.
We had a bit of a discussion the other day about the possibility to be reborn. For example, there's artificial
intelligence?
Insemination or something?
Oh, artificial insemination.
So I really can't get it how that works, or when a worm splits itself and then add two consciousnesses or something like that.
Yeah.
And the different
rebirths. Yeah. So the Buddha didn't talk about artificial insemination. They didn't have it at his time. Yeah. So this question comes up a lot. So what most people say, and it, you know, there's no clear-cut answer, is you can have the sperm and egg meet in the Petri dish, and if they start to create more cells, then that indicates that the consciousness has entered. So it could be that the consciousness was attached to the sperm, and when the sperm met the egg in the Petri dish, it happened that way. Or it could be that the sperm and egg met in the Petri dish and then a consciousness came in and joined it at that moment. Okay, and then the cells started increasing. Yeah. We don't know. Nobody sees it. Okay, so it's kind of those two ways that it could happen. But a more interesting question is what happens if you have a fertilized egg and then it's frozen? Yeah. Because when it's frozen, the cells don't keep reproducing. So is there a sentient being there that experiences a lot, very much cold? Yeah. Or could it possibly be that, you know, the cells reproduced a little bit, but there was no conscious there? But then after the fertilized egg is defrosted, and when it comes and is placed into the mother's womb, and if it adheres to the mother's womb, you know, at that time the consciousness comes in. Yeah, it could be that too. And it could be, because I remember His Holiness asking, you know, do all fertilized eggs become babies? And the answer is no. So it could be that the sperm and egg join in the womb, but it's only when they attach to the side of the womb and start growing that the consciousness enters. So we don't know the details of all of this. There's just several different theories how it could happen.
There may be no reason for this, but I was puzzled at the bottom of page 25, the paragraph, the last paragraph there that begins, generally speaking, once a mind conjoins with a fertilized egg, a new life has begun. I wondered why it was qualified with generally. What exception am I not noticing here?
Yeah, this is, you know, you always put generally in okay. I don't know, maybe there could be I don't know, maybe in the case of emanations, you know, if somebody's an emanation, their path of seeing, and they emanate, then it's, you know, not exactly a sperm and egg meeting and the consciousness entering, because the whole body is an emanation. So maybe it could be something like that. Here we're talking about a human birth. Yeah. Yeah, there are different kinds of birth, but here it's clearly talking about a human one.
When we were having the conversation about the consciousness coming into the egg and sperm, we were talking about I've heard the presentation that it's someone having the body being has a lustful mind towards seeing the parents.
Yeah.
Is that the only presentation of how that process happens? Because we were saying, like, in a Petri dish, what's going on there for that
right.
being to be lusting
after? Well, like
after?
I said, you know, they didn't. They talked about the kinds of fertilization that they knew about at the time of the Buddha. They didn't know about artificial insemination. Mm-hmm. So they described that one thing, yeah. But then when you have a new situation, then you have to think of how it could happen considering what that new situation is. And so those are the various alternatives that I described to you. It would be very strange if we read in a Buddhist sutra, you know, and in the Petri dish, this is what happens, you know.
I wonder whether there was an alternative presentation that I hadn't heard or read about.
No, that's the usual one that I hear. But you know, it's one presentation. There could be others, you know. Just because I haven't heard it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. So,
going back to your kind of indication of the Toko system and... I gave a BBC on that regarding Ling Rinpoche and pointing also a little bit out that it is helpful to have somebody in our life we can look up upon who has been supported in his or her development because they had already some good imprints. And so I really wonder what you're thinking about it. It seems like you're kind of against it, but then also you admire, of course, you know, all the Rinpoches who... are your teachers and
yeah. Oh, okay. I'm going to get on my soapbox. I'll try and make it quick. Okay, so we're not here all night. I look at it as it's a cultural system that was one of the reasons for developing it was to hand down property, because you had the lamas who were very good received a lot of offerings. They had a lot of property. They don't have children, or at least they shouldn't have children. And so what do you do with all the property when when they die? So having a tulku system makes it very clear what you do with the property. It also is a way, you know, when you have a lot of faith and trust and respect in a lama, of being able to kind of maintain it after your teacher dies by thinking that your teacher can be reborn and maybe you can meet them again in the future. Okay? And like you said, you know, it can be very helpful to prove rebirth to people, to be inspired if you think that this is the incarnation of your teacher and so on. However, what's happening now is there's an explosion of tulkus, because in the past it wasn't that every geshe was then had a tulku that was identified. It was just the very high lamas. But now everybody wants to the next rebirth of their teacher identified. So there's this whole explosion of tulkus. Okay? Then also, there was this fascinating book I read about 30 years ago. Somebody had done like their PhD thesis on the tulku system and had, interviewed all these tulkus. And then His Holiness had written the introduction to it. And I'd love to get a copy of this book. I've never seen it. I just read the bounded PhD thesis. Maybe somebody can look online and see if they can find it, because the interviews were really fascinating. But His Holiness, you know, said that not everybody who has the title Tulku or Rinpoche is necessarily a bodhisattva, necessarily has realizations or anything like that. He said some people just have enough good karma that they get that title. And now he very much says it's social status. And he says to the Rinpoches, you know, you got this title, now you have to really live up to it. Yeah, because it's also very easy for there to be abuse with this, because you're this big and you get a title, and then everybody starts, you know, throwing incredible amounts of money and possessions and things at you. What His Holiness says is, if a child very clearly shows some kind of, you know, attraction to the Dharma, and that there's undeniable indications that this kid is into the Dharma, then it makes sense to recognize them. But just to go out looking for the incarnation of somebody because you want to find it doesn't make much sense. And also, another thing that I think is, when you have all these Rinpoches, then it gives the rest of us the feeling that you have to be born as a Rinpoche. You know, you don't gain realizations in this life, you're born with them. And that can be a subtle factor that discourages people from trying. You know, depending on your mentality, some people might get discouraged. Okay? You know what His Holiness said about, you know, if there's undeniable evidence, then yeah, you got to recognize it. But otherwise, why are we making such a big deal about this? His Holiness's younger brother, Nari Rinpoche, he's amazing. He has this great sense of humor, and he's very direct and very outspoken. And he's a tulku. And he says the tulku system should be just disbanded and gotten rid of. Yeah, he doesn't see any benefit to it. And he's identified as a tulku. So, yeah. So it has its good sides, it has its bad sides, like everything. Yeah. And so some people will like it, some people won't like it. That's okay. I think what is important is whether you like it or dislike it, that whatever it is you believe helps you in your Dharma practice.